From 90.7 WFAE, this is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Rob Harrington became Charlotte's mayor about 2 months ago when Vi Lyles decided to retire. He'll only be in office through December of 2027 when a newly elected mayor takes his place, but he has a lot on his plate as City Council faces a deadline decision on the I-77 toll lanes, as they grapple with data centers, decide how to handle teen takeovers, and whether to apply for a federal Make America Safe Again grant, which may come with strings attached. A lawyer with no elected experience, he's also helping to navigate the choppy waters created by Raleigh. We'll talk about all of that, about his past experience, about his management style, and more with Mayor Rob Harrington this hour on Charlotte Talks. First, the news. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. The last time we had the mayor of Charlotte on this program, her name was Vi Lyles. In fact, she was on this program more than 50 times, partly because of the length of her tenure and partly because she made herself accessible to us. Hopefully the same will be said about her successor, Rob Harrington. His visits are likely not to be as numerous. Let's be honest, he just took the job 2 months ago and is only guaranteed to be the mayor through December of 2027. But with those few months under his belt and the full plate that he and Charlotte City Council are facing, he's made himself available to us for this hour, and so hopefully it'll be the first of many. So let's get to know our new mayor, Rob Harrington. Welcome to the program.
Good morning. I'm guessing I won't get to 50, but good to be accessible. Good to be with you, Mike.
You never know. You could be here once a week. Mayor Lyles, her decision to retire was a surprise to almost all of us because she had just won election for, I think, her fifth term in office. And for many Charlottesians, she was the only mayor they ever knew. So I want to get to know you. I want you to talk about yourself. You've never held, I don't think, elective office, public elective office.
That's correct.
You were the president of the Bar Association. I'm sure that's elected, but that's a whole different bowl of wax. So you've been a civic leader. You're a nationally recognized attorney. Who is Rob Harrington, and why on earth do you want to do this job, even on an interim basis?
You know, for once, I'll actually go in order of the question. So, you know, who am I? I have been in Charlotte for about 27 years, over 27 years. My family and I moved here. I had practiced law in Washington, D.C. and New Orleans for probably a total of 11, 12 years before that. We moved here. It was closer to home for both of us. I grew up in South Carolina. My son was probably going into third grade, I think, when we moved here. And we thought, and we moved here largely for my job. I, you know, was with a law firm in New Orleans. Had gotten to know the folks at the law firm that I practice at now, Robinson Bradshaw, through, you know, working together on some matters. And they called and said, you know, do you have any interest in potentially moving to Charlotte? And we looked at it. Gosh, we looked at it probably for a year because we were approaching mid-career where we were, and just decided that this would be a really good place to raise our family and to settle in and be closer to our respective, my wife's family and mine. And it's borne out. It's been a great place to be. But I've practiced law for more than 35 years now. Finished law school in 87, so approaching probably 40. And this has been a fantastic place to work.
It's also a lot less oppressively hot and humid than New Orleans.
You know, just before we came on the air, we had to report that we might get a heat index of 104 today. So we'll say that tomorrow.
So you're used to that. Hopefully, it's a lot less crooked than New Orleans allegedly is. We are told that the role of mayor in Charlotte, the way it's set up, is largely ceremonial. They run the meetings, they vote to break ties, they cut ribbons, they represent the city at various functions and greet dignitaries, etc. And they are the moral voice of the city. It's the person people look to when they want to to see how the city is regarding certain things. But how do you view this job?
I mean, I think you're sort of a point guard. I guess there are a couple of roles. I mean, one, I came into the job, looking to work with council to make sure that the process was orderly. One of the questions that all of us got who applied, but certainly the five of us that were finalists, was, how would you approach running meetings and running sort of the business of council? That's a priority of mine. You mentioned earlier that I was president of North Carolina Bar Association. Years ago, I was president of Mecklenburg County Bar, and I've, done a lot of chair of the Library Board of Trustees. I've run a lot of meetings.
Yeah.
And I think, for us, the way the city makes decisions and conducts business is through a majority vote of the council at a business meeting. And so the meetings really, people tuning into the meetings, people in the chambers at meetings and the council itself really need to have a sense of exactly what's going on and what the process is.
What's it been like herding the cats?
I've enjoyed it. I think we are making progress. We've had a couple of business meetings now. We've had two meetings. We had the zoning meeting, and we had the week before that, the first business meeting of August. I thought they were really successful meetings. We got through the agenda and got out because we've got really substantive issues to talk about,
yeah.
And the process of how we get through those issues is important.
Mayor Lyles abruptly resigned, if you want to look at it that way, because she literally had just won re-election. And you were among several people. I've forgotten how many now. Six, I think, that they were considering, five or six?
There were five finalists, having started with somewhere around 115 mm-hmm. folks who applied. And
I don't believe that you necessarily – did you approach them and say, I'd be interested in doing this on an interim basis, or did they approach you?
So it was an open application process.
Okay.
Applications were due early June, I think a Wednesday in okay. early June, and that number of people applied. I'd looked at the opportunity, thought about what I might bring to it, and decided it was a good time in career to take a shot at.
Why?
I think Charlotte has been very good to us. We raised our son here. He's now off and has children of his own. We take a lot of pride in the city. We feel like we owe the city a lot. And I say we because I'm constantly talking about my wife, Sharon, and I. And I thought at this particular juncture with Mayor Lyles, who's a good friend, having announced her intention to resign, with this period of transition, some of the skills that, I've developed hopefully over the time leading other organizations, and the knowledge of the city, having been involved yeah. in the art scene and the library scene, and knowing several of the folks on council, that I could come in and help us through this period in an efficient, orderly way, knowing that we've got some major issues out there.
You've only been mayor for 2 months, and already your wife has several roads named after her in Charlotte.
I
don't know how that happened. It's one thing, I guess, to throw your hat in the ring for a job like this, because it's terribly time-consuming if you do it right. And if you approach it the way Mayor Lyles and Pat McCrory and others have approached the job of mayor, it's terribly time-consuming. It's one thing to throw your hat in the ring. It's another to have them say, okay, you got it. What was the first thing that went through your mind when they said, okay, you got it?
I'd say excitement. I don't think you have to apply for something like that. You've got to be very serious going in. You can look forward to it, think you'll enjoy being in the mix. But ultimately, it's a very – we've got a million people, and we've got a multi-billion-dollar
yeah.
budget.
Yeah.
And you have to go into it with the seriousness of the job. I was pleased to have been appointed. You didn't know the answer until the very end. And I think I probably said that night, just ready to get to work.
Did you talk to other interim mayors like Dan Clodfelter and people like that about what it's like to be here, but only temporarily, and they know, and you know when the end date is? Did you talk to them at all?
So I got an email from Dan. I've not talked to any of them. I'm fortunate to be, pretty close friends with some of the other, former mayors. Mm-hmm. I know Richard Venrude is a partner of mine, has been for 27 years. I know Mayor Gant well. I know mm-hmm. Mayor Lyles well. And I have been able to talk to them about the job.
So we've talked a little bit about the fact that you I think you were born in South Carolina, I think in Florence.
Florence.
Mayor Lyles was born in Columbia, so we have two South Carolinians in a row as mayor. And then you moved to New Orleans for part of your career, and now you're back here in North Carolina. And you alluded to the fact that you've been involved civically in a lot of different organizations. I think you were the chair of the library board. You were on the Arts and Science Council. You were on the board of the Levine Museum of the New South, the Greater Charlotte Cultural Trust, and the Young Black Leaders Alliance, among others. That's just a few. Clearly, you don't mind working all the time. So why? When so many people sit at home after work every night and watch TV, what propels you to do otherwise?
Yeah, you know, I don't know that I've ever really had a night when I've went home and just watched TV. It's who I am. It's who we were, I think, as a family. I'm the youngest of five. All of us have been pretty deeply involved in some type of, the others were teachers, college professors, but we were raised to be involved in community. And, you know, I've told the story several times of, you know, watching my father do things at church and do things in the neighborhood and, you know, little acts of, you know, we talked a lot about philanthropy, but little acts of giving that we were just raised around. And yeah. So it becomes who you are.
Well, that's part of who you are, because obviously, however you were raised, they raised you right, as they say, because you went to Duke University, you graduated magna cum laude, you received, I think, top honors at Duke University's law school. What was it about your parents? What did they instill in you? How were you raised to view life?
There was an incredible emphasis on education. You know, more broadly, you know, we were told, you know, ordered, compelled to always do our best. That played itself out for us primarily in academics. And my mother in particular just never accepted less, realized to accomplish the things that, you know, she wanted us to accomplish, that my father wanted us to accomplish, we had to do really well. And easier for me because I was the last of five and the four before me had done it. So there was a pattern.
And it wasn't easy for them. It was a different time, hopefully, than it is today. It was not easy for them. Have we lost that? Have we lost that kind of ambition or that kind of expectation of young people today?
No, you know, I'll tell you a story. The first week I was in the government center, and I've been there every weekday except for the 3rd of July, the Friday before the 4th of July. Two of us got in the elevator together, a woman that I did not know, and then another woman got in after us, and she was on the phone and didn't seem to mind at all that, you know, we could hear the conversation, and clearly someone who works at the government center. And the other woman and I could overhear the conversation, and she was clearly talking to a child, presumably, you know, one of her children, and it was the same conversation I got as a youth however many years ago. It was, you know, remember that excellence is the standard. You do your best. You have to do your best. So I think we hear more stories about change in standards than really play out. There are an awful lot of people out there and an awful lot of parents out there who are supporting their kids and demanding the best for their kids. And I think, you know, in this community, supporting that and wrapping our arms around that as a community remains really important.
You're very connected to city leaders because of your involvement in various civic organizations around town. You know the levers of power. You've talked to previous mayors and members of council, et cetera. But now that you're in government, as opposed to being on the periphery of it, what surprised you most? What did you not anticipate that you have found to be the case now that you are in amongst these people every day?
You know, every time I've been interviewed, I've gotten that question, and not a whole lot. I mean, I've watched it closely enough. I think I went into it knowing that this is a full-time, all-encompassing job. But, you know, it's technically a part-time job, but this takes an awful lot of time. It is a really big city. I mean, we're the 14th largest city in the country. By the time this term is over, we're projected to be the 12th largest city in the country. I went into it realizing that the other leaders around me would have passion because I knew most of them going in. Mm-hmm. There haven't been a lot of surprises.
We're going to talk a lot about the issues that council and you as the mayor are facing in the coming months, but I also want to talk about what you just said, that it's a part-time position. The mayor is part-time. Council is part-time. And we're a million people, and we're the 14th largest city, I think, in the country, maybe bigger than that. Should it be part-time? We're going to talk about that and more when we come back at Charlotte Talks with Rob Harrington on WFAE.
Support comes from WFAE listeners and United Way of Greater Charlotte. Celebrating 95 years, United Way of Greater Charlotte supports education, financial stability, health, and essential services. Details at UnitedWayGreaterCLT.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Our guest today is Charlotte Mayor Rob Harrington. It sounds strange to say that after all these years, but it's true nonetheless. He's with us, just became mayor 2 months ago, and he will serve until late December 2027. We just talked about how the mayor is a part-time job, but it really is not. It really is all-encompassing if you do it right. And so is council, it seems to me, and probably so is county commission members. I mean, we're a big city now. We're not a small little burg. And I'm wondering how you feel about whether or not these should be full-time positions and compensated as such. Because there are a lot of things that happen, it seems to me, from an outsider's perspective, but somebody who talks to city council members and mayors over the last 30 years, that some mistakes get made, perhaps because there isn't time enough to devote the attention to what's facing council that needs to be devoted. And perhaps they depend too much on city management, which is not always on the same page, or they're being railroaded by city management because management are the experts. So I'm just wondering how you feel about this being a part-time position now.
Now, you know, my day job, at least before this, is as a lawyer, so I pull questions apart. There were a lot of pieces to that question, and I guess I'll start at the end. I mean, I think there's, in my view, a very good working relationship between the staff and mm-hmm. the staff leadership and council. You're right, the staff is there. They're, in many respects, you know, in many instances, experts in their field. Mm-hmm. And I think whatever the system is, you've got to rely on the expertise of folks who are brought in to work in certain areas. That said, you know, at the end of the day, these are jobs that demand full time. And I think, you know, most of the elected officials that are around me put what everybody else in the world would consider, you know, full-time into the job. So does the city at some point move towards making this a full-time job and having the pay reflect the effort that folks put into it? I think continuing to explore that's important, realizing that, you know, we've got a long tradition here of, you know, it's a manager-led system with largely folks who realize they're devoting a lot of their volunteer time to this effort. And the sort of public spirit-mindedness of doing that has been a big part of tradition here. But bottom line is, I mean, folks are working. The elected officials are working full-time jobs for the city.
And since you come to this from the outside, but now you're on the inside, there's been some discussion over the years about lengthening the term of mayors and city council members from 2 years to perhaps three or four. And the reason for that being is that if you just come on council and you've just been elected, it takes you 6 or 7 months to get your feet wet and to understand what the bathroom is and what the ins and outs of how all this works. And then you got to run for reelection. So what are your thoughts on that?
I think 2-year terms are tough. They're tough for Congress. You know, they're tough here because you do spend, as you said, you spend at the beginning of your term. I'm at the beginning of my term is coming in for Mayor Lyles. You do spend a bunch of time learning what the system is. I think the maybe more difficult thing is you spend so much of the cycle being concerned about running, both in terms of the time commitment to running and the orientation of being in campaign mode. So, again, something I think should be explored, whether we move for, you know, county and city and county from 2 years to 4 years. Again, realizing there is a importance to, there's a value to tradition, or at least there's a inertia to tradition that we need to pull against. But I do think both of those things are things that we should be looking at.
So let's talk about some of the things, because we have a lot of serious things that council is dealing with right now, as luck would have it. At the top of the list is a looming deadline on a decision by city council on whether or not to reverse their reversal of their support for the I-77 toll lanes. As a private citizen, before you got the job of mayor, I'm sure you were looking at these toll lanes and some of the options presented. What were your thoughts? Which way were you leaning personally at that time before you became mayor?
Well, I was looking at it a lot less closely than yeah. I am now. And I think in many respects, similar to now. I mean, it is potentially, if it's done right, it's a big investment. It's a big potential investment in the city. But the importance, of getting it right and having the space and process to get it right can't be overstated. I'm much more now familiar with the process and those concerns than I was looking in from the outside. But it's a potentially really big investment in the city.
So for people who were like you and not exactly tuned into this every day, it's not the top of their list of important things. Let me recap what's been going on here. After citizens expressed opposition to NCDOT's proposal to do what they want to do with the toll lanes on I-77 from the uptown area to the South Carolina line, even after an extended period in which citizens were encouraged by NCDOT to come in, look at the plans, ask questions, make suggestions, Charlotte and most other members of the Charlotte Area Regional Transportation Planning Organization decided to withdraw support for these lanes. And then the trouble began. NCDOT warned that these jurisdictions that voted no might have to pay back the funds that had already been expended to make those plans possible. I think it's to the tune of $60 million. They also alluded to the possibility that funding for other projects might either be withheld, withdrawn, or put at the bottom of the list. And some have said that, kind of a threat, might actually be illegal. Matthews Town Attorney Daniel Patterson recently took this position on the threats coming from the state.
Matthews nor any other local government seek this conflict, but cannot stand by and tacitly consent to be treated this way. Whether one agrees with the I-77 toll lanes project as proposed or not, this style of legislation should have no place in our state or our country, and I call on cooler heads to prevail at the state level than have thus far.
So you're a lawyer. What's your take on that?
Yeah, I mean, I'm a lawyer serving as mayor, and I don't know that I've avoided trying to take a legal take on it. We've got folks who give us advice on those issues,
right.
And in my capacity as lawyer, I've always been loathe to sort of be the voice for the client on a particular legal issue. All of that said, I think there is an importance to local determination, and you hear that from all sides and all kinds of discussions. I mean, the question of having a penalty imposed because of local decisions, I completely understand the fact that folks have recoiled from, been bothered by that concept. But I think when you step further back and you're looking at the best interests of Charlotte, which is my concern, we've got obviously regional interests and regional different players in the region have taken different positions through now. I mean, some never agreed, some rescinded, some have rescinded their or said that they will rescind their recension. It's all over the board. I came in, I did get informed, heavily on the issue before actually taking the office. And my focus has been making sure that under the time that's allowed, our council and our community have the best information we can to make an informed decision.
I know that the city manager and the attorney's office are both in discussions about and reviewing the language of the budget bill in which this penalty is written into law by was proposed by Vicki Sawyer, who represents Mecklenburg and Iredell counties in the legislature. Have you spoken with them about what their opinions are so far on this issue?
With the manager's office and the city attorney.
Yes.
Yeah, and I you know, from my own training, I won't get into the discussions that we've had with counsel. You know, I remain more focused myself as you know, mayor on understanding the timelines and making an informed decision on what to do. I want us to be able to look back 2 years from now, 3 years from now, and feel like we understood the parameters, we understood the benefits, we understood the downsides, and we heard from the community.
We seem to be moving into an era in which the party in power governs through threats. And this is happening from D.C. on down. And this is one of those instances. I think it can be clearly called a threat. And that is what some of these jurisdictions who have decided to reverse their reversal and say, okay, we'll support the plan, they're responding to the threat. Because $60 million will be divvied up, the responsibility for that money will be divvied up among the players on CARTPO. We're the largest player. We have the most votes. Therefore, we would have to shoulder the greatest burden of that $60 million if that stands. Is the city prepared for that?
I think if we get to that point, the city will figure out a way to deal with the ramifications. I have been resistant to talk as much about the consequences as the opportunities. Mm-hmm. I think council has to make and will make a principled decision on where to go. Of course, you got to consider the potential reimbursement, call it penalty, whatever. You also have to consider the potential investment. And those are, you know, both on some type of timeline, right? I mean, there's the risk of the reimbursement and the issues that go with the reimbursement and the questions of the, you know, validity of the reimbursement requirement. But there's also the, you know, potential for the overall investment. And Transportation Planning Committee meeting a couple of weeks ago, I want to make sure that we're focused on both of those, mm-hmm. and not just on the understandable reaction to a reimbursement requirement and the whether that's viable or not, but also on the other issues of what type of investments can be made in this community if we stay in the project step and participate in that investment.
Well, you talked about opportunities, and you just said investment, and one of the opportunities of staying in, I guess, was just recently presented by NCDOT in their response to the opposition. They have volunteered, if that's the word, to put $300 million in toll revenues toward the toward grocery stores, two grocery stores on the west side of town. It's a serious offer. Is it being seriously considered?
Well, I'm going to pick at your question a little bit again.
Okay.
It's $300 million. That's the number that's been floated. That number would come from the investment of, so there's a $600 million project. There's an additional, as I understand it, $100 million allocation. And then there's the $300 million number that's been mentioned that would come, you know, as a part of the investment from the participants in the project itself. Mm-hmm. And in the letter that you've probably seen, the letter that the Secretary of Transportation sent to community members and copied my office, he outlined, you know, several things that could be done with that, with that additional investment.
Right.
The working on food deserts in that area of town is one of them, but there are a lot of needs in that part of town as there are across the city, but there are a lot of needs in that part of town, many of which are derived from originally cutting I-77 through there that, you know, stand potentially to be addressed in some way with this investment. And I think it is being considered, carefully by the community. I know there are community groups that have been looking at it. And I think it's being considered seriously by council in the time that we have, balanced against concerns about whether the project is the right thing for the community at this point.
There are a lot of community groups on the west side who say no. The grocery stores, at least when it comes to grocery stores, these are things that should be here anyway. Don't bribe us with this. That's essentially what their position is. The North Carolina Retail Merchants Association claims that these proposed locations for these two stores, should they come to pass, are, quote, already served by multiple grocery retailers, including at least five stores within an approximately 3 to 10 minute drive, offering both full-service supermarkets and discount grocery options. People in that neighborhood say those stores don't exist, and they can't get to them if they do because they don't have cars. Is that why the disconnect? I mean, if you are the Department of Transportation, why don't you understand that?
Yeah, I mean, I think we're putting too much emphasis, in part because of that letter from the Grocers Association on grocery stores instead
of other
investments.
I mean, if they could put grocery stores there now, Kroger could come in there and do it. Food Lion could do it. Aldi could do it. They could all do it, but they don't want to do it because there's no money to be had.
You know,
they say, right?
I think you're right that food deserts shouldn't exist in our community, and that we need to find a way, if we have to, independent of this potential investment, to make sure that we don't have food deserts. I know there are groups that are working, you know, really hard on food co-ops now in that community.
Right.
But again, I think the importance that's been put on whether this is for grocery stores disguises a lot of the issue, and intentionally or not, disguises the issue of overall investments and things that can be done in that community.
There's still the need. The bottom line in all of this is that we're growing. We're not going to stop. I-77 is a major thoroughfare for not just local commuters, but also for people passing through the area. And I know some politicians have said we're not going to make decisions based on people passing through. We're going to serve our constituents, which is admirable and should be the case. But congestion is congestion, and it's not going to get any better. So in the end, when the sun has set on all of this, where do you see what is the ultimate solution here?
You know, there are narrower solutions and broader solutions.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously, we're working on all forms of transit and transportation in this community. You know, we're working, MB, the transit authority is working on designs for light rail across the city. We have this immediate situation with congestion on 77. And it's a Charlotte issue. It's also an issue for the entirety of the state and the region.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the question of being able to get from Columbia, South Carolina to Winston-Salem, you got to go through Charlotte and you got to go through I-77. And so it is a shared challenge faced across the state and across the region to make that work.
Right.
It's got to be addressed at some point. The question is this the best way to address it? Is this the investment that can be made now versus waiting some potentially extended period of time to do it?
And this is a project that has been a long time coming. I'm not sure how long we've been discussing this, but I know at least 5 to 6 or 7 or 8 years, maybe longer. And yet this is also another instance of getting almost to the finish line on a project, and suddenly we have second thoughts. It's like the bride at the altar having second thoughts. This happens over and over in city government, with the county commission, and in other locations. Ed Driggs would like to have now, he's a member of council, an independent study. And there's not time for that study, given the September deadline. Why does this keep happening? And I have 20 seconds.
I think this happens across the country. These decisions are tough. These are generational decisions, right? I mean, we're talking about a highway that cuts through the heart of the city and cuts through the heart of neighborhoods, and they're tough decisions.
Okay. We have to take a break. Rob Harrington, the new mayor of Charlotte, is our guest. We're coming right back. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. Mayor Robert Harrington is with us. Charlotte mayor, been in the job for 2 months. So we're really putting his nose to the grindstone here this morning. I want to hopscotch through some more issues that city council is facing, and you by extension. We're in the midst of Charlotte and communities around the country are in the midst of reconsidering their opinions about data centers. There's a moratorium here in Charlotte that ends on November the 5th. City Council wanted that moratorium in order to give them time to learn more about these facilities so they could make intelligent decisions about where they should be allowed to locate these facilities and how to regulate them. Where is the council in that process?
So council has appointed a task force. I think the task force has met either has met twice or has had one meeting and has another meeting that's scheduled in the immediate future. Individuals with background in the various disciplines that bring to, that data centers bring to bear, you know, real estate, technology. They're working through that information. It'll come back to council in time for the end of the moratorium, and council will proceed with a plan to move forward.
This is not unlike I-77, which is a fact of life. These are facts of life. Modern life depends. They run. This is the backbone of modern life, these data centers. Every single thing you do all day long goes through these data centers. Charlotte is not a foreign country to these data centers. We've had them for quite some time. Other areas of the country have had them for quite some time. Why all of a sudden is there this enormous pushback?
Well, I think it's the question of proliferation, right? I mean, you're right that we've dealt with data centers and the need for data centers for years. But with the advent, the further use of artificial intelligence, the need for them has grown.
Mm-hmm.
The need for them in locations that affect people in their daily lives, becomes, or the possibility of placing them adjacent to people has increased. As you said, there are moratoria all over the country. I mean, this is not a Charlotte issue.
Right.
If I'm remembering right, Waxhaw adopted a moratorium recently. It's an issue across North Carolina, across the country. In many respects, I think it's a bipartisan issue.
Yes.
Because there are challenges when they impact neighborhoods, water, electricity, transportation.
Noise.
And they're different depending on, you know, the size. And there are small data centers, there are large data centers. Completely agree with you that, you know, we use technology all day long. We're probably using it now. Certainly if we pick up our phone, we're using that relies on data centers. But we've got to find a way to make, you know, we're not going to slow down, at least in this process, yeah. AI. But we've got to find a way to make it, to make data centers something that folks can live with and not overly impact their lives. And not disproportionately affect the lives of one group over another.
And you've said that many times, and you've also said, but not without guardrails. So what should the guardrails be?
Yeah, I mean, I think in the permitting process, making sure that there's adequate provision for utility power, that there's that you minimize the impact, understand the impact, and minimize the impact on transportation. You mentioned it, that you muffle the noise as much as you can and make sure that that the noisiest of facilities don't have a disproportionate impact on neighborhoods. You know, one of the issues that stands out here, right, is that local government is constrained in what it can do in zoning. So, one of the questions is, can you essentially zone these things into certain areas? And, you know, we are a municipality in a state that the state is working through this itself, but, you know, the state is able to constrain what local municipalities can do. That said, I know Raleigh's working through this issue too.
Well, that's the other thing. I mean, I don't know how much power the city of Charlotte or Mecklenburg County or any municipality has versus Raleigh. That's a whole another bailiwick. But if you try to put controls on these data centers to address concerns about power usage and the increase in electric rates for other customers as a result of the need to build infrastructure to support these data centers, or water usage, or noise pollution, et cetera, do you run the risk of having them just say, well, heck, we'll go to Kentucky?
Well, that's an interesting question, and I think it's one of the things the task force is likely working through, but these are The sources that use data center, and I'm a lawyer and a history and religion major, so I don't want to get over my skis. but there is, these are global.
God is in the details.
Right? They're sort of global issues with global use, and so the question of where they're located and then where the benefits are available, is a question I suspect we need to look at. Again, I think we need to do what we can within the restrictions that we have to make sure that they don't disproportionately affect neighborhoods, and to make sure that the public understands that they're not being located and is confident they're not being located you know, in one location versus other locations that has an impact on one community, one group of people versus other people.
Another thing council's been concentrating on in recent weeks has been teen takeovers. I don't know how often these happen, but when they happen, they are very troubling. And you look at video of them on television and you think, oh, my God, if I were in the midst of that, what would my reaction be? Where this horde of teenagers who may be just out for a good time, I don't know, descend on one area of town or a shopping mall and sometimes wreak havoc and sometimes cause property damage. And council is trying to figure out what to do about that. You have said that these gatherings pose real risks and require action. Have you made any suggestions on what to do?
Yeah, so as you know, council has begun the process of considering a youth curfew,
right,
that's been proposed, I'd say proposed by the police department. I've got, you know, I've met with the chief, with Chief Patterson. I've got great confidence in her and the police department. And what she has said to council and said to probably each of us is that the police department needs the right tools to address these issues when they come up.
Part of the problem, as I understand it, is that the current curfew is that children 12 and under, have to be home by 10 and those 13 to 15 by 11. Well, kids that age don't have driver's licenses, and therefore they don't have ID.
That's
and some
exactly
of them
right.
might look older.
Yep.
Some of them might look younger. And it makes it very difficult on police to figure out what's what. So she has suggested that we lower the age for curfews.
Mayor and council, please hear me clearly when I say that we are not proposing to criminalize our youth. We don't want to criminalize them for being teenagers. We will not be instituting a curfew police. I don't have the staffing for it, so we will never do that. We are not creating a prison pipeline for youth of color.
Are people in our citizens concerned about her motivations for suggesting a citywide 9 p.m. curfew for everyone under 18? Is that part of the concern there?
Yeah, I have not heard concerns about motivation, and I certainly don't have concerns about motivation. I think the police department and the chief are looking for tools mm-hmm. to deal immediately with the, you know, the risk of takeovers rather than sitting there and waiting until, you know, 11 o'clock or whenever to take action. I think the community has expressed, concerns, some in the community and some on council, of what's the right balance. You certainly hear from the police department, and I believe them that they don't want to be in the business of overly enforcing curfew, but that they need a tool. And, you know, the council will continue to talk about that. But I think this is an area where we need to support the police department. I don't think it's a question of motives, but I think it's a question of making sure we've got the right tools.
I understand that you have been, I may be wrong about this, have been heavily involved in the discussions about these curfews. If that's true, which way do you see the wind blowing on council on this issue?
I think it's hard to tell. We're still having discussions. There's going to be, there's going to be at least one other, we've not voted. There may well be two sessions, one session where we further discuss and then that the council votes. I'll just speak for myself. I think that, I accept at face value that the department needs some additional tools. You mentioned the issue of younger teens not having ID, and so it's harder for them to check. I don't think the police department wants to, stop kids on the street.
Right.
But I think the community's got to have confidence that that's the case, that it will be a rational application of a tool. On the other hand, the takeovers have been real. Kids have been injured. Stores have been damaged. They scare the community. The flip side of this, though, and it's a really important part of this equation, is that we need to make sure as city and all of city's partners that we're providing places for kids to go.
That was my next question, because right. many people have brought up the need for third spaces.
Absolutely.
Not home, not school, someplace else that kids can congregate, socialize, have a good time, and not be in trouble. Do we have enough of those places? Do we have enough organizations, civic organizations, who are providing those spaces?
I think we've got to look for additional investments from the public sector in that. And I also think the public sector, part of our role, city, I don't speak for county, but I'll say county, city and county, need to make sure that we have coordinated with the houses of faith and mm-hmm. other organizations that provide spaces. But somehow we've got, I mean, when I was a teenager, you know, we went to the movies, we went to the malls, we went to parks. It was a different day. We didn't have social media. So many of the takeovers are organized around the rapidity of social media, which gets back to data centers, but the rapidity of social media. And we've got to adjust and adapt to the time that we're in. But we've got to have spaces for youth. Youth have got to feel valued in this community because they are the lifeline and the future of the community.
So following the murder, I'm going to switch gears here. Following the murder of Zarina Zarudzka on the Blue Line last year, investigations were launched at the local and the state level. Donald Trump had Zarina Zarudzka's mother at the State of the Union address to make a point. It got international headlines. Following all of that, Katz promised more security personnel. They promised stronger ticket verification. They promised expanded security technology. Have they followed through?
Yes, and one of the reasons the question is there is because the auditor released his report, recently on the aftermath. And you know, if you read the report closely, and I think the city of Charlotte has had a very good relationship with the auditor. Mm-hmm. I've met with him. If you read the report carefully, you can see that you have some that's a snapshot of what existed at the time. And then in the text and at times in the footnotes of it, you can see that the issues have been addressed. Yeah, it's a continuing process. We need to continue to work on it. But the investments of additional funds into security on the light rails, additional support from CMPD, has been great progress since that murder.
Except the audit shows that Katz has left $1.7 million earmarked for safety unspent. They also show that roughly 60% of light rail riders are evading fares. That means that, well, they're losing revenue, they're leaving money on the table. But it also, because since riders are infrequently asked if they have a ticket, it becomes an invitation for bad actors to access light rail for purposes other than transportation. Katz is run by the city. So how will the city respond to those criticisms and recommendations? Because one of the recommendations is to put up turnstiles and gates at all the stops.
Yeah, I'll take that in order. On the expenditure of the funds, what we understand from staff is they're working diligently to spend the money that's been allocated. It's a startup. So you're making sure, because the flip side criticism would be that you're spending the money wrong. So they're working very hard to make sure that the investments they're making are the right investments in the right measures and equipment. On the turnstiles, this system was designed many years ago. It's a open system. You don't come up or downstairs to get to it.
Right.
They've got to continue to work on technology to make sure that we're enforcing fares. In the meantime, the allocations to security have been increased. CMPD is working harder on it. More resources on security from CATS have been made. I'll step back to a larger issue on safety in general. One of the things that council did in the budget going into this year was to increase police pay and fire pay by 10%. So I think it's fairly easy to speak for council that security on and off the light rail remains, perhaps my biggest priority, but certainly a huge priority for council.
The current occupant of the Oval Office seems to like to target Democrats and Democrat cities and use the power invested in him to punish those for not following or towing the line of the administration. And that became very clear in democratically controlled cities like Chicago and Minneapolis and Charlotte last year, particularly with Operation Charlotte's Web here and ICE and other activities. Masked armed men carrying military-style weapons and riding in unmarked vehicles, carrying little if any identification, rounding up pedestrians, smashing vehicle windows and dragging people out of those cars, essentially disappearing them. It goes against everything we have always stood for as a country, and yet there are people still applauding on the sidelines for that activity. Democrats have taken an opposite stance, but there are people who criticize Democrats and the cities they control for being soft on immigration. Where does the truth exist?
I think another priority for the city of Charlotte is to make sure that our residents feel secure and welcomed here. For that reason, CMPD does not, which the city controls, does not enforce immigration laws. There is a limited amount that we can do to anticipate or stop government, federal government incursions into cities. But in the meantime, we have to make sure that folks know from the city of Charlotte that they're welcomed here, that residents are welcomed and appreciated. I had a chance last Saturday, to go out to, there was a horrific earthquake in Columbia. And not surprisingly, residents of Charlotte, and particularly folks in the Colombian community here, have been working really hard on food gathering and other gathering. Had a chance to go out and support those efforts last Saturday, planned to go out to the Colombian Festival on Saturday. What we can do as a community is make sure that we respect and support all of those who are working so hard to make Charlotte the place that it is, wherever they're from.
Well, thank you for the hour. I really appreciate it. Rob Harrington, our new mayor, one down, 49 to go.
Thanks, Mike. Great to be
welcome.
Here.
Thank you.
Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. Our producer is Chris Jones. Additional production assistance by Emmy Berger. For more information about Charlotte Talks, to visit past episodes, or to sign up for the podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com.